Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his new book, American Dynasty, political commentator and former Republican White House strategist Kevin Phillips traces the Bush family back four generations. He finds each generation more firmly rooted in oil and investment banking money and the nexus of privileged power that spans American politics and business. These ties, Phillips says, have now tainted America's top office, shrouding it in secrecy and influencing political appointments and the White House response to major developments from the Enron scandal to September 11th. Beyond passing down power and wealth, Phillips charges that the House of Bush has passed down an active penchant for, quote, secrecy and calculated deception. This may one day, may now, threaten the Republic itself, he says. These are big, deep, politically loaded charges. Kevin Phillips, stock in trade. Tonight on Point, the Bush family in power. Does a legacy of privilege and two Bush presidencies in a decade constitute an American dynasty? When you look at George W. Bush, do you see four generations of power and privilege assuming a throne? Is the Bush ascendancy a menace or an example of privileged men in honorable public service? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from West Goshen, Connecticut, is political and economic commentator Kevin Phillips. His new book is American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. Good evening and welcome, Kevin Phillips.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Kevin Phillips, it is not without precedent in the United States to have members of a single family in the White House. John Adams, 1797. John Quincy Adams, 1825. The Kennedys have held quite a bit of power in the United States. The Clintons, if Hillary Clinton should run and win again, you say yourself, might be seen as having a kind of dynasty. Why have you picked out, maybe picked on, the Bushes here?
Well, I think if Hillary does run in 2008 and does win, we're going to have a very interesting development and probably the second serious dynasty. But at this point in time, there's no comparison at all between the Adamses, who were separated by 24 years and in different parties. I mean, you just didn't have the same group of people around John Quincy that you had around his father. And that's absolutely the case with George W. He came in just 8 years after his father left. He basically was supported by the same money, a lot of the same people, the same regions of the country, the same interest groups, the same donors, and carried many of the same grudges and outlooks.
So when you say an American dynasty and you wrap that around the Bush family, you're not talking simply about two members of the same family, in this case father and son, both occupying the White House. It's that whole surround of connections that you're pointing to. Is that where your concern lies?
Yes, but I also think that it's a problem if you have a son with the same name and the same money and the same look coming in 8 years later. I mean, that bespeaks something in the American mind, as does the possibility of Hillary Clinton in 2008, that's turning to a more celebrity politics, but also accepting the role of great families in a way I think would have just appalled the Founding Fathers.
The Founding Fathers, because they saw a king on the throne in England, they had rebelled against that. They thought that could not, would not, should not happen in the United States?
Well, absolutely. George Washington was offered the crown sort of unofficially by people who really didn't have it to offer. But that whole view of politics, monarchy and aristocracy, was put aside. And to be drifting back in that direction, I think, is a real problem. And it would be added to, of course, if Hillary Clinton shows that even the Democrats are caught up in this.
Step back with us, Kevin Phillips, and look at the Bush family, the dynasty, as you label it. You go back 4 years, some more than that, because it's like all families, is an old family, but the privilege and wealth have gone back a ways. But give us a thumbnail sketch of the history of this family across those four decades to understand this nexus of power and interests and even instincts, I guess, that you're describing.
Well, the first thing you have to say is the length of time they've been thinking about the White House. It's clear that you've had two presidents. Before the two presidents, you had a grandfather of the current president who served in the Senate from 1952 to 1962, and his wife recorded that he wanted to be president, and he thought he could have been if he'd gotten into politics earlier. And by the early 1960s, when George W., the current president, was at Andover, he was already talking about his father wanting to be president. So the notion that, you know, they've sort of accidentally fallen into it is, I think, just, it's just not real. These people have been thinking about it for half a century and probably more. If you go back the four generations, you go back to George Herbert Walker and Sam Bush, who really emerged with some national influence during World War I, when they were both important early members of what Eisenhower ultimately named the military-industrial complex. It started emerging during World War I, and that's sort of a separate paragraph of thoughts, but it was a very powerful emergence in terms of money and influence and the underlying ties in the family to the military-industrial complex and the intelligence community.
Put some meat on the bones of what you mean by that, Kevin Phillips. Describe the underlying ties there, just how closely, how intimately, how enduringly has the Bush family, you know, been at that intersection?
Well, they started really in the just the first decade of the 20th century, and they've been very good at keeping this out of biographies. First of all, there haven't been many biographies, and the ones that have been written haven't picked it up. But George Herbert Walker was a major financier in St. Louis. During the war years, he got involved in war loans and the financing of war production. And by 1919, at the end of the war, he was offered a partnership by W. Averell Harriman, heir to the Union Pacific fortune. And they set up a company, W. A. Harriman and Company, in New York. They got very much involved, continuing with war industries, with shipping and aviation, but also building businesses and making huge investments in both Russia and Germany. And as they did this, they got caught up in all kinds of politics and overseas business and political intelligence, and became quite controversial and really played a major role in the evolution of the United States in that direction. Now, the other grandfather, Sam Bush, he was a steel company head in Ohio. Mm. It was Buckeye Steel. And that got involved in World War I production. But before I finish with the World War I aspect, they were in business with the Rockefellers. Mm-hmm. The Rockefellers and Standard Oil of Ohio were involved financially with Buckeye Steel. And Frank Rockefeller was the president. He was John D.'s younger brother before Sam Bush. Sam Bush, while being in the war production mode, also went to Washington in 1917 as the chief of the Small Arms, Ordnance, and Ammunition Division of the War Industries Board. Now, these were the people, basically, that regulated the munitions and armaments manufacturers in the United States. So it was quite a combination when you had Sam Bush's son marry George H. Walker's daughter in 1921.
You describe, you give a glimpse of the lifestyle of that family in those years. This is George Herbert Walker. That's the W in George W. Bush. Gosh, it's quite, I mean, not only was there the Kennebunkport summer house already, but the home in Santa Barbara, this opulent residence at One Sutton Place in Manhattan, country mansion on Long Island, Duncannon, a 10,000-acre estate in South Carolina, family traveling in a private railroad car, plenty of money here.
Absolutely. The whole notion that these people were upper middle class who really didn't have a whole lot of money to throw around is just totally wrong.
But we have the picture. Isn't it the one that George H.W. Bush tells of he and Barr getting in the station wagon and driving to Texas to seek their fortune?
I think it was a red Studebaker, because a couple of people have mocked the red Studebaker. It's pretty clear that he didn't go to Texas first. He went to Ohio, which was the head office of Dresser Industries in Cleveland. His father was a director of Dresser, had been for a number of years, and I'm sure just arranged it all with a phone call, because the chairman of Dresser was one of his old buddies. The whole notion of this plucky guy driving through dusty roads down to a job where he didn't know what to expect, it's absolute bunk. I mean, he did go down and work. I'm not saying he didn't work. He didn't just sit around and clip coupons. But the family has always been able to arrange things, and that was arranged.
So you draw a line then from these, the early involvement of Sam Bush and George Herbert Walker in high finance and in the crossover into arms and international finance, to the emergence of the American intelligence community mid-century and the opening of George Bush Sr.'s political career, his Washington career.
Yes, if you look at the grandfather, Prescott Bush, he did a lot of work with his father-in-law, George H. Walker, at the Harriman Company, and was involved in some of these Russian and German enterprises. But I don't really credit some of the overblown stuff about the German connections lasting into World War II. I think the real story there is that, yes, he did have German connections, but he was probably reporting quite a lot to the intelligence people. He was simultaneously a director of two companies that were involved in the atomic bomb project, and one of his companies, Dresser Industries, was manufacturing the incendiary bombs that the Air Force was dropping on Tokyo. So they've been in war production, you know, steadily. And then, of course, with George Bush Sr., his first job was with the company his father had been a director of for many years, Dresser. And what he did was the oil equipment side. But pretty quickly, he got into offshore oil drilling for Zapata Offshore, which was his company. And the argument there is that probably, and a number of people support this, but you can't prove it, probably he was a CIA asset during the time that he was doing this offshore oil drilling in the Caribbean, because at that point in time, the CIA, headed by Alan Dulles, a great friend of his father's, was worried about Cuba. And the idea is that the Bush oil business was part of the surveillance and then had something to do with the commercial supplies for the Bay of Pigs.
Kevin Phillips, a lot of people might hear all this and say, yes, fair enough, but there are any number of families of wealth of some duration in the United States. And George H.W. Bush was elected by the American people. He wasn't appointed to the presidency. So Americans, in effect, looked at this and said, fine, be president.
Well, they didn't look at it and say, fine, because they knew nothing about it. Basically, there was no serious biography of the Bushes or George Bush Sr. published before he was elected president. There was one in the early 1980s by his former press secretary. For some reason, that didn't happen, and I suspect it was because nobody thought it worthwhile to write a book about him for whatever reason, partly because there was the one out there and then another by another friend of his in 1989. But none of the books ever got into this. This was not known and not discussed in the press. So it's difficult to say people knew about it. Now, the serious aspect develops here, of course, that George Bush Sr. became CIA director in 1976. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, the United States was caught up in the sharply rising oil prices, and the CIA director was substantially charged with improving intelligence relations and the sale of U.S. armaments to Saudi Arabia and Iran, the two major oil producers. And Bush was very much involved with the intelligence chiefs in both Saudi Arabia and Iran. And that would become enormously significant over the next 25 years. And some of those connections still are. And then he became the first vice president and then the first president to come out of not just the oil business, but the intelligence community.
And you describe those factors as still very much in play today in the presidency of George W. Bush.
Unfortunately, yes. I think that what you have here is the first family, not simply to make a dynasty, but to make a dynasty that had as part of its coming to power this role in the CIA, and then when George Bush Sr. was vice president and president, that focused on the Middle East. And there were a number of scandals involved in this focus, and we forget them now, but they were very important by 1991 and 92, and they helped defeat George Bush Sr. in the 1992 election. I'm talking about the October surprise, which was related to Iran.
The release
Iran
of prisoners
Contra.
There just after Ronald Reagan's victory.
That's right. Then Iran-Contra. And then the third one is Iraqgate. Now, this one people forget, but this was the very central involvement in George Bush as vice president and then president in building up Saddam Hussein. You know, exactly that Saddam Hussein right up through 1990. And at that point, then Saddam thought he could do a little more than he did, and he invaded Kuwait. But people forget that buildup.
Kevin Phillips, stand by. We're talking tonight with political watchdog Kevin Phillips about four generations of power and privilege. In the House of Bush, do two Bush presidencies in a decade constitute an American dynasty? When you look at George W. Bush, do you see four generations of power and privilege assuming a throne or something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with political watchdog Kevin Phillips about four generations of the Bush family in American power and politics. His new book is American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the Bush ascendancy a menace to the Republic or an example of privileged men in public service? Does Kevin Phillips make too much of a family history, or do we have a problem here? Are the Bushes so different from the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, and maybe one day the Clintons? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin Phillips, point us straight to the bottom line here. You use some pretty strong language in this book and some strong ideas that the American Democratic Republic itself may be threatened by this kind of dynasty. Right in the title of your book, you've got deceit. What's sinister exactly here? There's a long line of power. There's a kind of handoff of that power. We see that. Where does the sinister come in? Where does the outright deceit come in?
Well, let me start with just the basic sense that if we do get a politics of great families and dynastic successions that spread not just into the Republicans but into the Democrats, and I think that's a threat to the Republican tradition with a small r and the Democratic mm-hmm. tradition with a small d. But let me be more specific on your question now. I think that the problem comes on one dimension, which is economic, where you get the whole proclivity for oil and Enron and top 1% economics, and I'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. But the most obvious one to me is that this role that George Bush Sr. has had, his 1 year as CIA director, might not strike people as enough to do it. And frankly, I don't think it was. I think he had an involvement before. There's a lot more that can be said about that. But by the time he became vice president, his job description basically within the Reagan administration was to be dealing with foreign crisis planning and the sort of difficulties that were emerging in the Middle East and elsewhere. Mm. And he approached it with a view of somebody whose whole background had been clandestine operations, covert relationships with the CIA, just as he had been when he was CIA director. You're blending the intelligence community and the executive branch more closely than before. And we go through these succession of scandals. Now, another scandal which knit in with Iran-Contra but went beyond it. The Bushes were part during the 1970 of the coming of age of the Arab oil nations as bankers. Mm-hmm. And the famous BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was set up in Abu Dhabi during that period. And some of the people who've written about it have suggested that Bush not only knew about it, but had some involvement with it because it was so central in the intelligence agencies, and they used it for armaments deals. Now, Bush was involved in an armaments deal in each of these scandals. The October surprise was an arms deal with Iran to keep the hostages, alleged to be that, to keep the hostages and not release them. The Iran-Contra was an arms deal with Iran. Iraqgate was providing arms to Saddam Hussein. This has been an armaments-focused man. That's what he did.
And you're saying this is somehow of a piece with being, in your word, a dynasty. Why?
Well, what I'm saying is you have somebody coming into office whose relationship to the office is not that of the usual president and goes further in to a clandestine establishment, the intelligence community, and behind that to a backdrop of all these connections in corporations, the defense sector, investment banking, law, all the white shoe firms. Now, what makes it dynastic further is that you have these succession of scandals They played a role in defeating George Bush Sr. in 1992. Then his son comes along in 2000. Basically, the media don't look at the connections and the shared constituencies and the shared almost everything. And then they wonder, you know, why are we involved in all these things? Why do we have this problem with saying what the Saudis did or did not have to do with 9/11? Why are we in Iraq? Why are we sucked into everything having to do with oil and Halliburton? Because it's a dynasty.
And the significance of that is you're saying that there are interests and history woven through each of these continents that made it attractive or inevitable that George W. Bush would be involved again?
Yes, I think so. But to explain why he was involved again, you have to look first at the circumstances in the Bush family, where even while George Sr. was in the White House, George W. was trying to run for governor of Texas. His mother talked him out of it in 1990. I mean, clearly they had it in mind, George W. and his brother Jeb, that there was a baton to be passed and they had to get into place. Now, in terms of what he did when he came to power, when he was elected, and of course he wasn't the choice of the people, we can't say the people ratified that because the plurality was not on his side. But when he got in there, he had this focus on the same things that his father had, which was upper income tax breaks, the top 1%, oil, finance, the Middle East, and Iraq. I mean, we look at everything that's in the news these days, and it's about, well, it turned out not to be weapons of mass destruction. It turned out that Bush was trying to get involved in Iraq almost from the time he was in office, according to Paul O'Neill, who sat through the cabinet meetings. I think it was way before that. I think that they had projects going. They've been written up in the foreign press, at least, in 1999 and 2000 about how they needed to take Iraq. This is something that hung over, and the president spoke to a Republican audience in Texas in 2002 and said that the Iraqi thing was a particularly American problem and challenge because they tried to assassinate his father. That was the supposed, and I think it did happen, the attempt in 1993 to assassinate Bush when he was in Kuwait. And George W. made a point that, you know, that made it particularly American. Nothing about weapons of mass destruction in that. So I have a problem with the inherited aspect of what's going on, A, in Iraq, and B, in Saudi Arabia.
But of course, Kevin Phillips, the Bush administration has a different answer for each one of these things. They look at upper income tax breaks and they say, this is economic stimulus. Oil, this is energy security. Iraq, Saddam Hussein dealing with this, matters of national security. You're saying each of these is a kind of facade in front of family interests?
No, what I'm saying is that you can go back four generations in each of these categories, and you can trace the Bushes through, in the four generations, they've been involved with 20 or 25 different banks and brokerage firms and investment houses. That's what they do. They help rich people make more money. It shouldn't be surprising that when they get in office, that's what they still do. They've been involved in the oil business going all the way back to John D. Rockefeller 100 years ago. And then in the Soviet Caucasus, which is 400 miles from Iraq in the 1920s, and then with Prescott Bush in World War II, and then with the two more recent Bushes, the oil business is part of their blood. Of course they're going to be favoring the oil sector. And then you get to the defense industry, and they've been in that for 100 years, too. I mean, it blows my mind. This has not appeared in the press sufficiently for the public to have known beans about it.
Maybe because it doesn't fit the American story of where presidents are supposed to come from. So
yes, it doesn't fit where they're supposed to come from.
So people don't want to see it that way. Kevin Phillips, there's a lot more we want to hear, but we have callers who want to join us, and I want to invite them in. Josh is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My question relates to George W. Bush and his brothers during the Vietnam War. It was a common complaint in the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s that very few children of members of Congress who supported the war actually served in Vietnam. We remembered during World War II that the sons of President Roosevelt were in the Army and saw action. I don't know enough about this, so I thought of asking Mr. Phillips, is it true that George W. and his brothers were able to avoid the war, and how did they manage to avoid service?
Kevin Phillips.
Well, George W. Went into the Texas Air National Guard. His father got him into it. He did it indirectly, but he got him into it. And he trained on a plane that was going to be taken out of Vietnam before he finished training on it, so he didn't have to worry about going to Vietnam. And the accusations have been made, I think, a little too flamboyantly by the Democrats that he was, quote-unquote, a deserter.
This is Michael Moore's word that Wesley Clark has stood next to.
Well, Wesley Clark didn't embrace the deserter phraseology, and I think he was wise not to. But I think what George W. Was absent without leave. Now, that covers a lesser version of things. Deserting requires, you know, proven longevity of simply having gone somewhere else or maybe even gone over to the enemy in the worst kind. And that's not involved here. He just, I think, didn't feel that the rules applied to him and that he could fix it. And I think he was AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard. And the whole notion that he can parade around on the deck of a carrier and put kids in a shooting gallery while he was AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard, that's not terribly impressive.
And how about the brothers of George W.?
Well, I'm not aware that Jeb served, but he may well have. So if he did, it was
not born until 53, so he wouldn't have been much exposed to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, he might have. He had to register, I'm sure, and he might have had to draw a number one year. But I think it's fair to say that he really wasn't under the gun and the others would have been too young.
On the other hand, George W.'s father, George Bush, President Number One, famously served and served with some valor in World War II.
Well, yes. Now, there are some questions about that, too, and they get very interesting. Critics of the Bushes say that what happened in the crash of former President Bush's plane wasn't quite on the up and up, and one of the people who flew with him made this charge, and then others raced to defend him, and I don't think it's been totally satisfactorily resolved, but forget that. There's a larger question here, and again, all I can do is pose it, but Prescott Bush, the father of the president, was a director of a German bank that was seized. Its assets were seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Now, I don't think that there was anything involved there that really caused any problems. I think probably Prescott Bush was talking to the intelligence authorities about this. But it's just possible that one of the reasons why George H.W. really wanted to get into the services very much underage for pilot training was because he felt embarrassed. His father obviously had to get him special permission because he didn't meet the age and university requirements. He was just out of prep school. So I think there's more to that than meets the eye. But
you're seeing a kind of need to burnish the family reputation to put those German connections behind them.
Well, to put the rumors, because I don't think there really were serious German connections.
David's calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. As far as I'm concerned, George Bush is an honorable man, and he's been chosen by the people that supported him, and he beat the people that voted against him and the people that didn't vote. And the thing is that people have always usurped power when there's been no opposition. Now, our Constitution protects minorities. It's a form of government set up like that. And the problem is, I mean, I see nothing wrong with George Bush. My only criticism is that I don't go along with the people that voted for him. I'm not of the persuasion. He simply represents the people that voted for him.
So you're saying, David, if more people turned out and voted, maybe he wouldn't have won, but he did.
He would have seen
or at least he got the White House anyway.
He would have had different policies.
Kevin Phillips, here's this notion again. He may not have won the plurality, but he ended up in the White House. If there had been overwhelming opposition, that clearly couldn't have happened. People are voting. Presidents are taking office.
Well, I guess I would say here he's the first president since 1888 who did not win a plurality of the popular vote. He's the first president to be chosen by a one-vote decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Something like 38% of Americans still believe, according to polls in late summer of last year, that he's not legitimately elected. So I would say he is different. The family circumstances make it different, too. much of this was not sufficiently before the public in 2000, and I think part of that's the fault of the media, but part of it's the fault of the Democrats. You had Al Gore, who was the son of a senator. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was trying to build his own dynasty. This is just widespread now in both parties, and the Republicans with the Bushes are the most extreme example, but I'm perfectly willing to concede that a lot of the Democrats would do it, too, and I think it's a dangerous thing for it to be happening in either side.
So even the Democratic opponent wouldn't necessarily feel free to throw stones because he had his own father on Capitol Hill.
Well, I think that's right.
Paul is calling from New Berlin, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Thank you. I can appreciate this idea of following in one's father's footsteps. My father had been chosen as a director, national director for the Foreign Policy Association, and made a presentation back in 1976 to Congress, the Subcommittee on Foreign Relations, of a survey, the first survey of the nation, about 40,000 people, well-informed opinions of the people regarding eight issues on the nation. And my family goes back to the first governor of the colonies, the Smith, and middle name Lincoln from Abe's grandfather, and first name from a former head of a Democratic Party of Wisconsin.
So are you pro-dynasty, Paul? Is that where you're coming from?
What I'm saying is that there's a compulsion that goes along with a namesake and a lineage in your family. But I chose one that was not my father's industrial involvement, but a more altruistic nature to be a voice for the people. Question is George Jr., is, do you see anything in his character and his philosophy that is a departure from his father and his family? I understand this compulsion that seems to guide him in many of his policies, but do you see any indication that he is anything other than his daddy's son?
Kevin Phillips.
Well, oh, yes, absolutely. The key economic loyalties, I think, are all in the same direction as his father's were. But there is a huge difference in the cultural persona. And part of that is his desire to texify himself. And I'm not sure exactly when that took over, but some people think in the late 1970s when he lost a congressional election in West Texas because they kidded him for being so Eastern and so preppy and, you know, Yale and Harvard and so forth. But more importantly, in the 1980s, he had his religious experience and became, and I take him seriously here, became extremely religious to the extent that it was reported in many places by many people that in 1999 and 2000, he was telling religious leaders that he thought God had told him and wanted him to run. And then in 2003, in the lead up to the war with Iraq, he was making it very clear that he sort of regarded himself as having been chosen again after 9/11 to lead the country in its hour of crisis. And he encouraged a lot of the religious right leaders to feel that way. In 2000, 84% of the fundamentalists and evangelicals in the United States voted for George W. They constituted 40% of his electorate in 2000. So there's this enormous difference. He has a tie to people that his father was uncomfortable around, and it's a very shaping tie, in my opinion. I think it influences him profoundly and in a quasi-megalomaniacal way. I mean, I think he just thinks he's been chosen.
Paul, thanks for your call. Does that constitute then, Kevin Phillips, a fundamental break with the Bush line, the Bush view of the world that you're describing here, or just an additional facet?
I think it's an additional facet because it points him for somewhat different reasons in the same direction. I think oil continues to push him towards the Middle East, but I think we have to say in addition that the sense of the Middle East as the biblical battleground, and believe it or not, 46% of American Christians believe in Armageddon and the end times. So it wouldn't surprise me if he did, but he's never been asked. I think that creates a context for policymaking in the Middle East that bothers me again. None of our previous presidents have gone into battle based on that, and Carter didn't even pursue his own very biblical views.
Kevin Phillips, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with political watchdog Kevin Phillips about four generations of power and privilege. In the House of Bush, his new book is American Dynasty. You can join our conversation. Does Kevin Phillips make too much of a family history, or do we have a problem here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with political watchdog Kevin Phillips about four generations of the Bush family in American power and politics. His new book is American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. What do you think? Is the weight of privileged families in politics, of this family in politics, corrupting to American democracy, or is it a fact of life that the Republic deals with, even desires? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tony's calling from Raleigh, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for this show. I am in a household of two, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I think we're very concerned about exactly what Kevin Phillips is talking about. I find we've thought about it as a problem of attitudes, of a sort of theocracy that goes back to the very beginnings of the old families who came to this country with the sense of the select, and even that they knew better than what they were leaving in the old country, religiously speaking.
But that's led to a lot of people who stood up and served the country, Tony. Are you saying on balance you don't think that's a positive?
In the old days, there was something called noblesse oblige. I think we're now in a day and age of noblesse non oblige, which means you can be privileged, but you do not have to extend your hand out to others. And there's also an attitude that we find disturbing, that the rich know best, the glossy, beautiful people know best, and the poor deserve what they get. If they work hard enough, they obviously haven't worked hard enough, or they'd be rich.
Tony, thanks for calling. Let us pick that up. Kevin Phillips, Tony sees a kind of continuity with American history, but also a break.
I think I agree with almost everything she said. I think we used to have people that took far more seriously the injunctions that they would hear in the New England private schools and see on the walls of these same schools. And I don't think the Bushes really do that. I think that they have a sense of entitlement. And I was wondering myself if you wanted to say noblesse, non oblige, however exactly you would do it. But I think even if it's not grammatical, it really makes the point that there is a culture of celebrity that's come into being, that there is a culture of great families, that more and more of these great families simply don't work and live on the same planet as the ordinary American in a way that even Washington or Jefferson would have found hard to comprehend. And I think we are in danger from that.
Kevin Phillips, we have a Bush on the line. Jonathan Bush calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Bush.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Jonathan, what do you make of this conversation?
Well, you know, half of me wishes I left for work a little later, but I'm glad to have heard it, I guess.
Are you a Bush of the Bush family that we're discussing, Jonathan?
Yes, yes. The religious fanatic is my cousin. I don't think of him that way, but
you're talking of the president.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess my impression is that, you know, Phillips might, I guess it sells a lot of books to cross lines, but I feel like there's a line crossed here where certainly he's definitely, you know, felt a lot of religious conviction in as he mentioned, since the twins were born, and that's guided him a lot.
President Bush, you know, that is, yes.
Yeah, President Bush. But I guess the whole idea is sort of arrogance or, you know, just kind of blindness that he suggests, or the entitlement that he suggests, seems so disconnected from that. In fact, it seems to me, just knowing him growing up, that that experience has made him a lot more humble, a lot more obligated, a lot more focused on his obligations than he had ever been. And when I look at his presidency, it's quite the opposite. I mean, I could list a dozen decisions that he's made that every advisor he had said don't make, but he said, gee, you know, it's got to be the right thing to do.
Jonathan Bush, let me ask you, when you...
I don't know why I would have made those decisions.
Jonathan Bush, let me ask you, when you sit around at family gatherings at Kennebunkport, you know, do people, I don't know, lift a glass and toast the Bush dynasty?
No, never. Absolutely not. That's an absolute absurdity. There's jokes about it because people read rags and say, somebody just said Bush dynasty, ha-ha. But, you know, it's an absolute sort of anathema that the Bush family would be treated that way, that anybody would do anything because of the name. Whenever a little cousin, you know, says yes to a network about some interview, that everybody kind of secretly knows, gee, that might have been because she's related to this or that. it's a very cold chill that runs through the dining room. It's totally the opposite. It's almost a fearing of dynasty implications that might sully the good work of somebody who's trying to do community service in a way that they think is important.
Kevin Phillips,
from what Kevin is describing, that's what's sort of surprising to me.
Kevin, here's a Bush in our midst, and he says they just don't see it this way.
Well, I wish that this is Jonathan Bush, I'm sure, who is the current president's uncle.
Cousin.
This is the son of that guy, Kevin.
Oh, okay, right. Well, I don't know whether you're in the financial business, but I know that your father was and many, many other Bushes. And I'd sort of be interested in getting your take on whether it's unfair to discuss the all the way back to W.A. Harriman and Company and G.H. Walker and Company and many, many others, dozens of others, that this is a total focus of the Bushes over four generations. Would you like to say that's not true of your father and your uncles?
You mean to be in financial services?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Well, I guess, first of all, no. I mean, Dad's got a financial services firm, and I didn't go into it, and my brother didn't go into it. None of my cousins have gone into financial services, so no, absolutely not. But I guess I separate the private sector pursuits of people. Yeah, you know, you go in the family business. I mean, I don't think of going into the family business as somehow sort of obligating you to be a selfish jerk. And that therefore any community services you might do with the wealth you accumulate would be sullied by that. In fact, I think it's the opposite. If you accumulate wealth and you say, okay, that's enough for me, now I'm going to go do community service and make no money, isn't that what you would want? I mean, isn't that a good thing for that person to do as opposed to sort of roll in it forever?
Kevin Phillips, speak to that.
I'm not sure we're talking about the same family here. I could take your cousin George W.'s business career, your cousin Jeb's business career, your cousin Marvin's business career, your cousin Neil's business career in particular, and trace it relentlessly to crony capitalism, to deals with people who had connections with government and were involved in, you know, foreign banks that were a little bit of a rogue bank and so forth. And this is sloughed off. Now, I understand that you can't discuss this with me. I wish that your cousins of two generations were available for interviews, but they ain't.
Well, there looks like...
Let's separate. Again, it doesn't sound like you're... I mean... I guess I should be on the defensive, but yet you're not really answering this question about the separation, Kevin. There's the notion of making money and using family relationships and dad's Rolodex to make money, which is one debate and worth having. And then there's another debate, which is when you've made money and you go into community service, public service, politics, whatever it may be. You know, my dad worked at the Boys Club. My dad did the United Negro College Fund. When you do that, are you somehow permanently damaged by the fact that you've made money by starting where your dad left off?
Jonathan Bush, we're going to have to let that question stand there because our time is so short, but we're happy to hear tonight from the cousin of the president, and thanks for calling in. Kevin Phillips, we've just got a minute and a half left here. How do you answer that finally?
Well, frankly, I don't see too much to answer. One of the things I make as a point in the preface is that the family has been nice to work for, according to people who've worked for them. They have been involved in community service. However, when it gets to be making decisions and showing loyalties in politics, they really go back just relentlessly to the groups that they've been part of, the top 1% economic group, oil, the business establishment, the intelligence community, the military side. They do it relentlessly, and of course, they always have compassionate conservatism or something out there as rhetoric, but, you know, frankly, I think that's just about all it is.
You know, Kevin Phillips says, follow the money, follow the interests. We will try and sort through all of it. We thank you for the book and for raising the issues, Kevin Phillips, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Kevin Phillips, author of American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, when candidates try to make us laugh, this is On Point. With the primary season now in full swing, the Democratic candidates for president are looking for every opportunity to forge a human connection with voters. Wesley Clark served up pancakes in Oklahoma City today. John Kerry always has his wife nearby. And last week, the fiery Howard Dean took to late-night TV to try and be funny.
And the number one way Howard Dean can turn things around?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe fewer crazy red-faced rants?
Veteran political joke writer Mark Katz says humor is one of the easiest tools a politician can use to connect with voters. Katz was Bill Clinton's in-house joke writer and is author of the forthcoming book Clinton and Me, a real-life political comedy. In this radio diary, Katz explains the power of humor in politics.
Humor is kind of a rare opportunity, I think, to speak the subtext of things that would otherwise go unsaid. What I love most about humor in the political discourse is that it allows candidates to express themselves in ways that the political discourse, as strictly defined by kind of sound bites and speeches and meet the press appearances, don't regularly allow for. I think it's an underutilized voice, quite honestly, in our national political life. Because a person, a candidate, gets to tacitly acknowledge the things that otherwise are whispered behind his back. I personally believe candidates would be wise to let their humor voice come out more to connect with people in ways that the political discourse doesn't allow for it otherwise. A good humor writer will understand what the natural sense of humor of the person they're writing for and help them to express it perhaps better than they otherwise might. When I worked with President Clinton, one-liners were actually not his strong suit. With him, especially kind of telling things in more of a narrative arc, telling stories, telling funny anecdotes that we would invent and narrative arcs that were just kind of comic in premise, were better than just the one-liners, the rat-a-tat-tat one-liners that you might fill up a page with when you sit down to write. But the stuff that worked best for him, that kind of allowed him to best express himself, were stories and anecdotes that tapped into his natural talents as a communicator. Humor in politics, not surprisingly, is political and tactical. And part of the fun of the job that I've had is trying to figure out how to solve a problem using humor. And there are topics that are difficult to discuss. And to me, the challenge was always to figure out exactly where the line was and to find the joke that goes up and touches the line, that walks right brazenly right up to that line and says, "Hi there," and touches it in such a way that lets the room know, or the television audience know, that this topic doesn't scare you. With specific reference to the Clinton White House, you know, the impeachment comes to mind, which was a very difficult set of circumstances. And I remember the rule that we arrived at the White House and how to handle it, which was, we can do jokes about the smoke and not the fire. We could talk about the spectacle and the circus of impeachment, but you never really saw the president do a joke about what brought us to the brink of impeachment. What a joke can never do is change someone's mind about a hardcore political belief, but it can help personalize a person. I mean, if George Bush told a joke that made me laugh, it would in some way change my opinion about him. There is a joke that he could tell, I haven't heard it yet, that would make me say, yeah, this guy's okay. You know, I know everything I know about him, and I still believe everything I believe about him, but at the moment that I'm laughing, it kind of puts a crack in what was a hardened opinion. And that is the real and not insignificant power of humor.
Mark Katz was an in-house joke writer for President Bill Clinton. His forthcoming book is titled Clinton and Me, a Real-Life Political Comedy. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Michael Garth and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.